And our next speaker is a professor from the University of North Dakota, Scott Corum. Drove down yesterday and is here to talk to us today about geological processes linking electron donors and aquifers and the implications for Minnesota.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's quite an honor for me to be here. So let's go ahead and move on. We heard from Peter McMahon that these oxidation reduction processes affect the chemical quality of groundwater in all aquifer systems. And he mentioned these three issues: mobilization and generation of undesirable products, and degradation of anthropogenic contaminants, as well as with respect to porosity, creating or maybe destroying porosity. And I'd like to come at this from the perspective of the degrading of anthropogenic contaminant nitrate. And so my talk will focus on nitrate, but hopefully some of the electron donors that I talk about, it could involve whatever you're interested in with respects to redox reactions. So just a quick primer on denitrification. Denitrification's a reduction process, and so there it serves as an electron acceptor, and so you have to have electron donors. Of course, you have to have nitrate or nitrite, some of these nitrogen oxide sources. You have to have bacteria. And from my perspective, I assume the bacteria are down there. You know, nitrate's been available for a long time, even at the high levels that we've been using since World War II. The assumption is that there are bacteria down there that can mediate the process. And as also pointed out this morning, you need to have dissolved oxygen at lower levels, because the first and most energetic electron acceptor is oxygen, and then you go to nitrate, and then you have your metals, and then you have sulfate reduction and methanogenesis. But from a hydrogeological point of view, the thing that I think is really most important is, do we have suitable electron donors? Because again, as been pointed out, if you have suitable electron donors, your oxygen is going to be used up fairly quickly. And once oxygen is used up in a groundwater supply, it's not easy to replace it, surely not by diffusion. Diffusion's a very slow process, maybe with recharge waters, but even then it's not typically a very fast process relative to denitrification if you have suitable electron donors. And by suitable electron donors, talking about things like organic carbon, which has been mentioned already, and sulfides, perhaps organic sulfide as well as inorganic sulfide in the form of pyrite. That's what we find. I mean, there are other metallic sulfides around, but I think sulfite pyrite is by far the most abundant, and also perhaps some of these ferrous iron minerals. So the way that we've come to this is with what we call in situ mesocosms. So we have these big stainless steel chambers. I mean, it looks like we're putting miso silos or something like that in. But these things are about 5 feet high and 16 inches in diameter. And what we do, if you look closely, so our goal is, at least my goal is, to get these things in nitrate-reducing zones. We want to try to estimate, you know, the denitrification potential and denitrification rates. We want to try to maximize those things rather than minimize, because these things are expensive to put in, as you can imagine. But the basic idea to put these things in is we have a big auger, and we auger down until the formation begins to collapse, which is typically around the water table. So maybe 2, 3, 4 meters down. And then we pound in a temporary casing represented here, which is about 2 feet in diameter. And we use a sand baler to agitate the waters and to clear the sand out and dump it then on the side. And in oftentimes, particularly if we have flowing sands, we want to keep a positive hydraulic pressure. So we'll pump water in, formation water, to keep a positive pressure to keep those sands from backfilling when we remove them. And then once we get down to the bottom of that temporary casing where we want to install the ISM, this in situ mesocosm, which may be anywhere from 10 to 25 feet below the ground surface and maybe 2 or 3 or 4 meters below the water surface, then we set this chamber down into the relatively undisturbed sediments, and then we pound it down into the sediments, and we just have an aquifer mesocosm. And so here's a cartoon of the finished product. Early on, what we did is we put these things in pairs. So we had a nitrate chamber and we had a control. And so in the nitrate chamber, what we would do is we would pump out at least 3 pore volumes of formation water to make sure that we had, in fact, the natural groundwater in these chambers, these stainless steel chambers. They're open at the bottom, okay? Maybe I didn't make that too clear, but these guys are open at the bottom. Everywhere else they're closed off, and we have some pipes and tubing that goes on up to the surface. So we would pump 3 pore volumes out, and they have a pore volume of about 60 liters. And the good news with that is that you can take samples for 2 or 3 years, and you can do a lot of analyses with it and look at saturation indices and some of those things and begin to get some idea of what caused the denitrification. So we'd pump the water out, and in one, we labeled it, well, we amended it with bromide to serve as a tracer for nitrate, and then with nitrate. And then we just allowed it to siphon back into the ISM. And then with the other one, we would pull out our sample similarly, but we would just amend it with bromide, sodium bromide typically, at the concentration, at the ionic strength of the nitrate into bromide that we had done earlier. So then we just come back and sample, you know, once a month or once every 2 months for as long as we could or as long as we had the funding to do that. And so this is a summary of our network of in situ mesocosms. And I want to point out that all of these are in glacial outwash aquifers. In this region of North Dakota, South Dakota, Western Minnesota, we're not part of any large regional scale aquifers. These are all sand and gravel outwash aquifers. And the first one that we put in is this Larimore site in the Elk Valley Aquifer, which was an underflow fan into Glacial Lake Agassiz during the retreat of the last glaciation. And we've done 6 tests in this, so you can reproduce them, which is kind of fun. And we get rates of everywhere from about 0.1 to about 0.2 milligrams per liter per day. And these are all with respect to zero order rates. At the Elk Valley site in Larimore, it truly is a zero order rate. Some of the other sites really get a better fit for first order denitrification rates, concentration dependent denitrification rates. But it's hard for me at least to really quantify that. So I've all reported them. I've reported all of them with respect to zero order rates so you can get a feel for it. But, you know, 0.1 to 0.2 milligrams per liter per day, you know, if you need to get rid of a few milligrams per liter per day, you know, it doesn't take very long, a few weeks or something like that. So this aquifer is really kind of our champion aquifer so far. At least it was. We think we have another one that's better. And there have been studies done by Bill Hsu, a colleague of mine at the State Water Commission, and this aquifer has enough electron donors to last for hundreds of years. So it's really just full of electron donors. We look at some of these other sites, and it's not quite as optimistic, but not all bad. We have this Hamar site, which is to the west, maybe only 60 to 80 kilometers west of our Larimore site, and we don't really measure much denitrification. And we think that's probably not true for the whole aquifer, but you know, looking back, we realize we probably put this in a recharge zone, and perhaps some of the electron donors have been weathered over the last few thousand years. Maybe that's an alternative. We have the Karlsruhe site, number 3, out by Minot, North Dakota. This is a pretty good site. We have 2 sites. One of them has just a little bit of denitrification. Another one is able to support quite a bit more. So this is really our second best site, the S site there. And we have the Robinson site. The Akeley, Minnesota site is along the Shingebis River. When we looked for some of the sites to put in Minnesota, what we did, well, frankly, we did kind of like what's been shown already. We looked at some of the electron acceptors and some of the results. We tried to find areas where you didn't have a lot of oxygen, where you didn't have very much nitrate, where you had elevated iron. It wasn't quite as sophisticated as some of the presentations already given, but the basic idea of geochemical indicators. And so when we got to Minnesota, I'm not from the state of Minnesota. I don't know the geology so well, but we struggled a little bit with finding aquifers that can denitrify. And the sites that we did find tended to be near the rivers. So number 5, the Akeley site is along the Shingebis River. Number 6, the Perham sites are along the Ottertail River that Peter McMahon mentioned earlier today. And then Site 7 is along the Rock River, way down in the southwest corner of the state. But you see that the rates are all pretty uniform. There's not a great amount of variation there, other than these two sites, the Larimore site and the Karlsruhe G site, S site. You know, they're about 0.01 to 0.04 milligrams per liter per day, which isn't insignificant when you consider the amount of time groundwater can stay in the system. Then we also have a couple of sites down in Iowa that we monitored with the USGS. And again, you see a little bit of denitrification. This is along the South Fork of the Iowa River. Not a lot. And I suppose another reason why we put them by rivers because farmers don't like to have wells in their fields. So that's probably another reason. But we did seem to find that the wells that seemed to show the denitrification, in Minnesota at least, were around rivers. And that makes some sense. I think that, you know, you have these rivers meandering across the floodplain and you're burying organic carbon, and so you have a source of electron donors that might be more recent. So we started to ask the question, why in the world is the Larimore, the Elk Valley Aquifer, the number one star there, why does it have so many electron donors? And the other ones don't seem to have the electron donors and don't seem to support the denitrification. And are there other aquifers where this might be true? So we began to do a little bit of checking. You know, you think about it, when the glaciers came down, it was very cold. From my point of view, you wouldn't think there'd be a whole lot of organic carbon that would be buried and entrained in these outwashed sediments as they are deposited in its buried valleys or perhaps as underflow fans in Lake Agassiz or outwash plains, whatever. So I don't think that we have a lot of the electron donors aren't there because of glacial activity burying a lot of organic carbon. Maybe that's true in some cases. I just mentioned we have some rivers that seem to entrain some organic carbon. But I don't think that's the principal source of electron donors, at least not for the Elk Valley Aquifer. And so we can look at some of the different rock units. On your left, we have the discontinuous ferromagnesian series. And there is iron associated with that, some ferrous iron. So perhaps you have some outwash aquifers that reflect some of these igneous rocks. There may be some denitrification potential because of the iron. Probably not too much. You know, iron isn't a... when you consider like the oxidation of sulfide, you go from sulfide at minus one oxidation state to sulfate minus, what is it, six? So you have a transfer of a lot of electrons, whereas ferrous going to ferric has a transfer of one. So it takes a lot, relatively speaking, a fair amount of ferrous iron to denitrify a significant amount of nitrate. And then on the right, we have the continuous plagioclase feldspar series, and not a lot of iron necessarily associated with that. But again, there may be some iron associated with some of these igneous rocks. Here's a paper from France in the Brittany region in northwest France. And if you can read the small print, probably you can. I'll try to read it for you. But they talk about these changes, denitrification really, are attributed to the development of equilibrium between the physical flow parameters and the chemical kinetics of autotrophic denitrification processes that occur in the pyrite-bearing fractures. So here's a fractured rock aquifer. Again, this is not something that I'm concentrating on, but it might be. There may be examples of this in Minnesota. And in the fractures, for whatever reason, there's some pyrite. And that pyrite's highly reactive. It very aggressively denitrifies. And they don't find a lot of nitrate once that nitrate gets into that system and interacts with the pyrite in those fractures. Not the focus of my talk, but just some ideas that might ring some bells with some of you in Minnesota that might be important. So from my point of view, and others I'm confident in the room would have a similar point of view, that shales, the sedimentary rocks, seem to be the source, the potential source for lots of electron donors. And you think of the environment in which shales are produced. You have a marine environment, an offshore marine environment. You have this cycling of life, really. And so we have this organic carbon here that's oxidized by oxygen, maybe in the water column to CO2. We don't really see nitrate in this picture. You know, geologically, over time, nitrate hasn't been believed to be a common or a high constant contaminant or constituent of seawater. But we see the oxygen, the nitrate isn't there, but then we have the metals are kind of implied because here we have some pyrite nodules. And so when we have the sulfate reduction cycle going on here, those metals, reduced metals, will react with the sulfides and produce some inorganic sulfide. And so shales, I think, are something to really be considered. Well, the eastern part of North Dakota has a lot of these Cretaceous shales, these marine shales. And to the west, this lighter green area, that's the Pier Shale. So this area here is the Pier Shale. And then the Niobrara, well, it's that real thin strip, kind of pinkish colored here. And in the Carlisle, a little bit further to the east, again, another shade of green. And then we have the Greenhorn Formation, maybe more of a tan. And we have some other formations where I don't have any data on. But is there, you know, when we think of these glaciers coming down and chewing up the exposed bedrock, and then we have the outwash, are some of these shales then being deposited? And you see the Elk Valley Aquifer there, which again is an underflow fan in Lake Agassiz. So what we did is we went out and we began to collect some samples from this region underneath the sand and gravel aquifers, in the shales. And you see several in the pier. Again, that's the major green area is the pier. We have the Niobrara, a few in the Carlisle, and a few in the Greenhorn. So it's kind of expensive. The State Water Commission helped us a lot with this during one of their summer drilling seasons. And so then we analyzed these sediments for some of these electron donors. We looked at organic carbon, for example. And so you can see that the organic carbon in these eastern exposed bedrock units looks like it's higher than it is in the Pier Shale. And so the idea is that if we have glacial outwash aquifers that show that signature, that have shale fragments from the eastern part, they might have more denitrification than those to the west with the pier. And then we have organic sulfide, not a whole lot of organic sulfide, and this is pretty consistent with other people that have looked at some of these shales. It seems to be that the inorganic sulfide is more of a significant source of sulfide than the organic. But we see a little bit. Again, it seems to be, if you can look at those little dots, maybe a little bit more to the east than there is in the pier formation. We also measured inorganic sulfide, and you can see that, again, it looks like we have more in those bedrock units that cropped out, at least when the glaciers were coming down, on the eastern part of the state. And then total ferrous iron, well, that seems to be fairly broad in terms of its distribution. We have a fair amount of ferrous iron in the Pier Shale as well as in these units to the east. So if we look at this in total, again, we don't have a lot of samples, but if we look at the pier, you can kind of see these bar charts. We have a fair amount of iron associated with the pier, but not too much of the carbon and the sulfides. The Niobrara, well, quite a bit. The Carlisle, well, two data points. And then the Greenhorn. But taken as a whole, we have, you know, the Niobrara, Carlisle, and Greenhorn, 9 data points and an 11 in the pier. And so we did some statistical analysis of this. And this is using a non-parametric test, the Spearman test. And the hypothesis, frankly, that we were trying to disprove was that there was no positive correlation of the two donors' average values at a statistical level of significance of 5%. And so we do see an apparent correlation with inorganic sulfide and organic sulfide, probably not a surprise. And we also see a statistical correlation with inorganic sulfide and organic carbon. And not at the 5% level, but at the 10% level, we see a statistical correlation with inorganic sulfide and iron. And of course, we do think the inorganic sulfide, based upon XRD work, that it is pyrite, at least as far as we can discern. There are probably some other stuff in there, but not at significant levels. And then the organic sulfide is also correlated with the organic carbon, but not with the iron. And then the organic carbon is not associated with the ferrous iron. And then also, to try to just get a sense of this with respect to the spatial direction, we see that the inorganic sulfide, the organic sulfide, and the organic carbon are correlated with the easternmost side of our sample area. So that's why we have longitude down there. So we do see a correlation with those other eastern units beside the pier. Well, so then what we did is we got a map of the aquifers in North Dakota that are close to these bedrock units that seem to have high electron donor concentrations. And so you see that one circled. I should point out that number 5 is the Elk Valley Aquifer. That's the one that's our champion. Number 5 up here, this teardrop shape. And really, the Fordville up here and the Inkster are all a continuation, really, of this teardrop shaped. Maybe not so much the Fordville, but the Inkster and the Elk Valley really at one time were continuous but have been intersected by a stream, the Fordville River, the Forest River. But we looked at the Inglevale. Now, you know, we don't have a lot of resources in North Dakota, so we can't put these ISMs in everywhere we go. But some preliminary indication does seem to indicate that, yes, in fact, the Inglevale aquifer does have some denitrification. So we look at nitrate samples, and we look at the oxygen 18 as versus the N15, and we see this characteristic increase between the two that has a slope of about 0.5, which is characteristic of denitrification. So with these data, at least, it does suggest that we do have denitrification in the Inglevale aquifer. Not a lot of data, but some support, and surely a place where we can get some more information and maybe do some more study. Well, then we had an opportunity to go down to the Oaks aquifer, again, another glacial outwash aquifer, way down that goes into South Dakota. And you see that there to the bottom. And we put in some more ISMs down there, a pair of them, actually. And so those sites went in really about the time that we were doing this study with the electron donor concentrations in the shale bedrock. And you see that as that kind of orange-tan star there. And again, this is upland. This is not by a river, not that close, maybe a mile or so from the James River, but it's upland. This is right in the middle of an aquifer. All of our sites, particularly in North Dakota, all of our sites are intensively farmed. So the Elk Valley Aquifer, again, that's star number one. If you look at it from a vulnerability assessment, ignoring the geochemistry for a minute, it's one of our most vulnerable aquifers in the entire state. We have like 170 aquifers. It ranks number 4 in the entire state system. And the reason is it's level, it's sand, the water table's 10 feet or so, you know, just 2 or 3 meters below the ground surface. There's no confining layer at all, and it's intensively farmed. So, you know, corn, potatoes, small grains, soybeans, and things like that. But yet it has this abundant supply of electron donors, so we don't really think it's an issue. So we can take that off the list for now with respect to vulnerability and maybe look at some of our best management practices on some of these other aquifers that may be more vulnerable to nitrate. Anyway, we went down to the Elk Valley site, the Oak site down to the south, and we see a lot of denitrification, at least in one of our sets of ISMs. So the two green lines, that's kind of the maximum, the dashed line is the minimum of the denitrification rates that we see in our set of ISMs in the Elk Valley Aquifer. We go to the Oaks G site, which is in the finer sediments, and we compare that to the slowest rate we got at the Oaks C site, which is in coarser sediments, and so we envelop that range. But, you know, a lot of denitrification. I mean, that stuff really goes away. And, you know, some of my colleagues had done some studies earlier. And NDSU, the other guys, they've been studying this Oak site for years and years and years, and they scratched their heads. Man, this nitrate's disappearing. Where's it going? And one of the hypotheses was it was being denitrified in the drain tile because they would see these high nitrate concentrations out in the aquifer, but they would take water samples in the drain tile, and all the nitrate was gone, or not gone, but maybe 1 or 2 milligrams per liter. But when we went down there and we saw the amount of electron donors in the sediments, as well as the denitrification rates that it could support, I'm confident, and we also did a tracer test in the drain tiles, I'm confident that the denitrification rate in the aquifer sediments is at least as great as the denitrification rate in the drain tile, and the residence time in the drain tile is several hours, whereas in the aquifer it may be, you know, weeks or months or years. Well, what are the implications for Minnesota? Well, you know, I got to be really brave or crazy to do this because I'm not a geologist in Minnesota. And so I just put this up maybe to kind of have you guys do some thinking or maybe ring some bells in your own mind. But, you know, we see the pink area, which we have, you know, to the north. You know, we have some rocks and there may be quite a bit of iron in there. Maybe you have some metamorphosed rocks that have some schists and some pyrites or something like that. I don't know, but that would be something for you to look at. But on the other hand, in the northern part of the state, there's not a lot of agriculture, so I don't know that nitrate's an issue. I may be wrong, but I'm guessing that. So the area that seems to be really of interest is this gray area that we have here down in this region, a little bit of gray area up here, and these are the Cretaceous rocks. These are the shales. And as far as I can tell, based upon this map and also a more elaborate bedrock geology map, apparently those shales are not, they're not defined. They're undivided. Okay, and you can see that word there, undivided. So I don't know if they're, you know, Niobrara, Belfersh, or Carlisle, or what, but that might be something to discern and try to decide, because some of these shales have a lot more electron donors than other shales do. And that's just my little message with respect to denitrification. So are there some small sand and gravel aquifers out in Minnesota that have a huge capacity for denitrification? And maybe the Minnesota Department of Agriculture can say, because we have all these electron donors, we're not going to invest a lot of money on best management practices for those particular aquifers. Maybe we'll go to some of these others because we have limited resources. Even Minnesota has limited resources, right? We have limited resources, and so we're going to try to find those aquifers where we have fewer electron donors. And again, to go back to this paper by Mike Trojan and his colleagues talking about some of these aquifers, four regions in North Dakota, in Minnesota, you know, a bedrock aquifer in southeast Minnesota exhibits aerobic conditions when overlain by surficial deposits lacking shale, whereas anaerobic conditions occurred under deposits that contain shale. But are all the shales the same? I don't know. But that might be an area of interest for some people here and some of the agencies represented. So again, these areas of shale that crop out in North Dakota, they're not very big. They're quite small. But we do think we have a lot of aquifers, or at least in that area, those aquifers that are in that area, that have a tremendous capacity to denitrify, and we're still, of course, following that up. And in our case, you know, this stuff has been studied a lot, particularly with respect to some of the smaller aquifers in Europe, particularly. So there's a geological analog to where we are in this region in Europe. And so, of course, you can study the USGS papers that we have here, as well as some of the European papers. But this is just my kind of tongue-in-cheek reason why perhaps we're not as far along on some of these small glacial aquifers in terms of research as the Europeans. And that's because you look at some of these small areas in this region, there's just not a lot of resources available, just not a lot of people in these areas. Something else that you might want to consider that's big time right now. This is a press release. You can go down to that website. This just came out, I think, in the last week. But enhanced denitrification. And so you have guys like Lewis Shipper down in New Zealand who does a lot of work with this, as well as Art Gold, University of Rhode Island. But are there ways that we can add electron donors to our aquifers to cause denitrification? And so in the early years, 20, 30 years ago, the idea was to inject liquid forms of electron donors. And that can work to some extent, but it doesn't seem to work that great. I mean, it can work for remediation systems at a point source perspective, but for a distributed source, not so well. But what these guys are doing is, you know, Robertson up in University of Waterloo, what these guys do is dig trenches and add sawdust or some other form of organic carbon and then bury it and then study the loss of nitrate. And that might be something that's worthwhile in Minnesota. But here we have, I don't know where this is, but this is the cover of the Ecological Engineering. And that date up there, this is volume 36, issue 11, November 2010. And then apparently this is in Iowa, but you can see this large section where they have apparently some groundwater flow leaving an agricultural field that they're sending through one of these buried zones of enhanced denitrification to try to encourage that. Well, in conclusion, the reactivity of the aquifers in North Dakota is highly variable. So we have some aquifers that have, you know, their world champion status in terms of denitrification rates, and they seem to, like they could do that, support that denitrification for many, many years. We have other areas where there's virtually no denitrification or very low rates, below our levels to even measure it. And most of the reactive aquifers appear to be associated with shale bedrock units that are also high in electron donors. An exception would be out at that Karlsruhe site, maybe some shale out there, but also some lignite. So there's some organic carbon from that perspective. And also there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Acknowledgements, well, I worked 10 years ago with people in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, also the Minnesota Department of Health, and I see some of those folks here, and then also the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, as well as you can imagine a lot of state support from North Dakota, some of the North Dakota Water Resources Research Institutes from the USGS, and some USGS funding to do that work in Iowa, some US Bureau of Reclamation land, and lots of graduate students. I'm pointing out Ryan because he really did the work with the analysis of the electron donors, and we have a picture of Ryan. But I'd like to thank you again for inviting me. It's really been fun for me to come down so far and participate. So thank you. Well, you know, Peter McMahon could talk a lot more about that in some other areas. What we do is we compare it with the tracer of bromide, and we look at the isotopic enrichment of N15 as a substantiative evidence. But, you know, the USGS does a lot of work with gases that I think are really better than just looking at a bromide tracer, particularly in a natural setting. So we have kind of a setting where we can actually set up a mesocosm, and the bromide, I think, works fine there. But in a natural setting, again, talk with Peter. Maybe you want to address that, Peter, but the gases, I think, are the way to go. No, that's an interesting comment, though. I haven't personally. In North Dakota, this is interesting, it's unusual to have pesticide breakthroughs. And again, my suspicion is because many of our aquifers have such organic carbon loads that there's a lot of adsorption going on. But Tim's done some work down in the... Tim, are you around here? There, Tim Cowder. He's done some work in the Cheyenne Delta Aquifer, which is down in the southeast corner of the state. And relative to the Otter Tail Outwash Aquifer to the east, it was a surprising difference in the amount of pesticides. So generally, North Dakota doesn't have the issues with pesticides that Minnesota has. And I think it's not because... I don't want to get in trouble here, but I don't think it's because our farmers are, you know, better stewards necessarily than the Minnesota farmers. I think it's because of the inherent characteristics of our aquifer sediments relative to Minnesota. I think they're just more organic carbon, but I'm not sure of that. That's my suspicion. Yeah, I didn't actually report that in this particular presentation, but at the Elk Valley Aquifer, our percent organic carbon is about 0.5%, and our percent inorganic carbon, it varies, but at our particular site, it's about 0.5% again as sulfide, not as pyrite, as sulfide. Yeah, I talked about organic carbon as 0.5%. The inorganic sulfide as sulfide is about 0.5% also. Okay. And so for an aquifer, yeah. as a rough qualitative estimate, we've gone back at each one of these sites and we look at the amount of electron donors and just adding them up, we see a correlation and we break it up into three categories: high denitrification potential, medium, and low. And there does seem to be a correlation that the ones with the most electron donors in terms of a weight fraction percent have the greater amount of denitrification. The ones with the lower have a less amount. So there, in terms of rate, there does seem to be a qualitative relationship that way. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, I think, before you can really be quantitative, but qualitatively, I think that's a fair criterion.
Yeah, we don't with our work, because we can only put these things in one location. And so we have 5 foot of sediments. And in our particular, so we could determine, if the denitrification rate increased with time as we sampled, as that the water in that lower part of the ISM makes its way up to the upper part where we sample out of. We don't see a lot of correlation with that. So within 5 feet, no. But again, I think the work from the USGS at least suggests that you have this vertical stratification, the oxygen zone, the nitrate-reducing zone, the metals, that would suggest that there probably is more denitrification at those lower, potential at those lower depths. But we can't really get at that the way that we're sampling.